Today's scripture reading is from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58. As a result of all this, my loved brothers and sisters, you must stand firm, unshakable, excelling in the work of the Lord as always, because you know that your labor isn't going to be for nothing in the Lord. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Please be seated.
Well, good morning, friends. My name is Chris Abel. If you're a guest with us today, I just want to say how happy we are that you're with us, and I hope that you get something meaningful out of today's service. I am glad to be back in here. I was gone last week because Beth, my girlfriend, who's here in the front row, and we were out with her parents out in Vermont on the Appalachian Trail. Her dad's a section hiker and has done almost 2,000 miles of the Appalachian Trail over the last 15 years or so, and which is a pretty impressive feat. He's getting a little older now, and he moves a little slower, and so he asked that we join him, and so this is something we've been planning for 6 months, and so I think she'd kill me if I didn't make it, and so I went. So that I don't make a habit of going taking a week away 6 weeks into a job, but thanks for giving me some grace, everyone. But I'm glad to be back, and I feel like I did something this week that I feel like I need to confess to you all. And, you know, on the trail, my hair was kind of getting in my eyes, and I was all sweaty, and I needed a hat, so I went into a local gas station, and I kind of have a big head, so it's hard for me to find hats, and some of you guys, you have this problem too. And so the only hat that would fit me was a Patriots hat. So I bought a Patriots hat this week, I'm sorry. And so we got off the plane, and I had it on, I was like, oh no, and I like stuffed it away. So, go Chiefs. Okay, so we are continuing. We're actually wrapping up our series called Reclaimed. And we've been talking about this idea of how God has worked throughout past over and over and over to reclaim things. Sometimes we have this ideal that faith is stale or it's rigid or that people in the past had it all figured out. But over and over and over and over, God has done new things throughout time and throughout history and with people throughout generations. And so we talked about how God reclaimed the first century Jewish people and invited them to reclaim their purpose, not just the best years, their past. And then we talked about the Christians, the early Christians, and how they had a debate about what the different ways that their faith could be reclaimed, and yet God unified them even in their differences. We talked about Methodism and the start in the 1700s and how God used that as a movement to reclaim the church that had gotten stale. And then last week, Erica preached about this church and how God has reclaimed this church through our history and through our present. And this week, I want to talk about the future of church, the future of faith, the future of what God not only reclaimed past tense, but will reclaim future tense. And to do that, the best way to talk about the future, I find, is to talk about sci-fi. Is anyone here a fan of science fiction? All right, seven of us are really going to enjoy this sermon. Even if you're not a fan of sci-fi or science fiction, I have an illustration that I think you'll at least track with. And so I'm a fan of sci-fi. I don't know why. I just think it's really cool to imagine like other worlds and other scenarios and situations and how science and life intersect and different things. I love that kind of stuff. I read books about it. I watch TV shows about it. I go see movies about this stuff. I'm a big fan of the sci-fi of the 1960s and 70s especially. Sci-fi then, it was like the golden era. Sci-fi then was really hopeful. You have authors like Arthur C. Clarke or Isaac Asimov, and they wrote these books about a future where humanity just really flourished. It was about, a lot of it was about space travel. It was about how our technology would just transcend, how we would transcend all of our kind of human problems and become something greater. It was about encountering other life forms. It was about like what possibilities were out there. Science fiction in the 60s and 70s was very, very hopeful. You, even if you're not a fan of like 60s sci-fi books, which is probably most of you, you probably have still seen this show at least, Star Trek. That's right. The Star Trek series was this kind of sci-fi. It was this imagination of what humanity could look like someday. And so here, you know, Spock's a different race, but you have these other guys. And, you had this show that was about humanity at the edges of the universe, about exploring the world. You may not know this about Star Trek, and I'm revealing my nerd side here, but in Star Trek, they live in a world where currency doesn't exist anymore, and everybody works just because they want to contribute to society as a whole. role. And when your gifts are actually honed from birth, and then you get to do the job that's best suited to your personality, and everybody cohesively works together for the good of humanity, and then explores the stars, and then comes across predicaments that they overcome with logic and reasoning and hope. That's Star Trek. The new Star Trek, if you've watched it, it's garbage. And it's garbage not because I'm a Trekkie or anything like that. It's garbage because they've lost that sense of hope entirely. The new Star Trek's like an action movie. There's weird romance stuff. It's the stuff's blowing up. There's subterfuge. It's darker. And so they think that they're going to get better ratings by going darker. The original stuff was really, really hopeful. And what happened with sci-fi over the years and over the decades is in the 80s, it started to take a turn to be more cynical, to be more negative, to be a little darker. And we started getting movies like Terminator. And so you might know the 11th Terminator movie is coming out next month or something like that. And just over and over, they need to save the future because it's, like, think about this. We go from Star Trek that's like the future is hopeful to all of a sudden we have the future is going to be destroyed. It's going to be terrible. It's going to fall apart. It's going to be apocalyptic. And we need to try to avoid it. And yet they keep making movies, which essentially they're saying is we just keep pushing back the inevitable apocalypse that's going to keep coming. And if you think about sci-fi today, you know, students, you guys probably know more of these shows than most of the rest of the folks here. But we've got like The Walking Dead show, which you probably shouldn't be watching. Which is about zombies, right? It's violent, and it's gory, and it's about a post-apocalyptic society. And then you've got things like Ready Player One, which was a movie that came out last year. So that one's pretty cool, but it's about how the world stinks, and you need to escape into the internet because the world falls apart. And then you've got Hunger Games, which is a post-apocalyptic society where they throw children into a fighting pit for some reason. And then you have Avatar, which was a movie that came out 10 years ago, but until this last year, until Avengers Endgame, it was the highest grossing movie of all time for like 10 years. It kept its ranking. And that's a movie about the future of Earth stinks and you have to escape onto another planet. Like this is again and again and again and again, these movies in our sci-fi, we imagine that everything falls apart and we need to escape or we need to survive or there's just a few of us that are left. Like this is what our science fiction has become. If you think about it, comic books, movies, books, all of it, it's like how are things falling apart? What blows my mind about this is fiction. You can imagine, you can pretend anything you want, and yet all of our pretending is negative. All of our fiction has become how things are going to fall apart. And I have a theory. This is just my personal theory. I think sci-fi has shifted because this is how society has shifted. That we watch this stuff because all of us somewhere inside feels like stuff's falling apart, not getting better. Times have changed. And I don't know about you, but sometimes when it comes to the future, I feel a little cynical. I can lose my hope about where things are going. I don't watch the news a lot, but when I do, I feel like just 5 minutes and I feel like a pit in my stomach. I feel like the world is not headed in a good direction. I feel like there's a lot of distrust in society lately. I feel like there's a lot of anger and a lot of judgment. I feel like even when you look at politics for like 2 seconds and you have these parties that almost want to sabotage the other party more than actually do any meaningful change in the world. And I feel like, what happened? Paradoxically, while we have our tribes that we kind of stick to and we shoot arrows at the other person, we also we're more individualistic than ever before. All sorts of studies show that people don't have friendships like we used to have. There were studies that said, you know, in the 70s, the majority of Americans would hang out with their neighbors on their porch twice a week or more, the majority of people. Now if somebody stepped on your porch, you'd probably go find a weapon. You know, like this is just like not the world we live in anymore. We are more and more individualistic. And then it comes to like when you think about how it used to be like people owned little stores and you could go in and, you know, you could make a living off of having a little merchant shop or something. And now we have these corporations that run everything and they're trying to squeeze every cent out of profits and use up people and discard people. There's this I don't care mentality out there. As long as I get mine, as long as I'm okay, anything else is fine. And you see the results of a society like this. We have anxiety and depression that's skyrocketing. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, it's estimated that 31.9% of 13 to 18-year-olds in the United States suffer from anxiety disorders. That's one-third of our teenagers are not equipped to handle the world emotionally and psychologically. Think about that. We do not live in a world that lends itself to human flourishing. And you all probably feel that way too. I know it breaks my heart sometimes when I think about this stuff. Suicide is on the rise. An incredible low number of people feel that they have a sense of purpose. No wonder our sci-fi is a little darker. No wonder it imagines a world that falls apart, because it feels like the world's falling apart. In fact, it feels that like hope is more unrealistic than zombies or time travel. It feels like hope is more unrealistic than time travel or zombies. That you'd be foolish to be hopeful about the future. So what does this have to do with church? You didn't come here to, you didn't wake up this morning and think, oh, I can't wait to hear about a sci-fi sermon or about Star Trek. No, what does this have to do with church? What does this have to do with following Christ? Well, one thing I've come to see over the years is that Christians don't actually know what the Christian faith says about the future. If you ask someone on the street, if you went to downtown Blue Springs and you got someone coming out of the liquor store and said, hey, sir, what does the Bible say about the future? They'd be like, why are you talking to me? And then they'd say, well, I don't really know. Like, why, you know, what does it say? Most people would say they don't have a clue about what Christians believe about the future. Some people might say, well, I read those Left Behind books, which is apocalyptic fiction. That's not what the Bible says. Others might say, oh, it's the end times. God, you know, defeats evil. You might even get a sciencey person who says, well, final entropy is what awaits in the future. People, we don't really have a sense. We don't teach in churches what we believe as Christians about what the future looks like. And there's a huge part of the Christian faith that's about what's going to happen. What's the future? And yet churches everywhere aren't talking about it at all. And so we don't have vocabulary to talk about what we believe is going to happen in the future. And so we get pulled into where society is going. We are just as likely to be cynical as anyone else, even though we're Christians. So, I want to talk about what happens at the end of the Bible, and then what it means for you today. And the end of the Bible is a book called Revelation. Now, some of you might have tried to read this at one point. You were doing a devotional plan, and you're like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever read in my life. And then went back to Matthew, right, or the Psalms. Some of you know somebody who's, like, obsessed with Revelation, and it's like, oh, the locusts in Revelation, those are Black Hawk helicopters, you know, and they're just like, they see weird stuff in Revelation. So there's some people who love it. It's like they're as obsessed with that as I am with Star Trek. And so this book is really controversial for people. It's really confusing for people. So I want to give you a little background. Revelation is actually a letter. It's a letter from a man named John the Elder. Some people believe this is John who followed Jesus. Other people think it was a different John because the writing style is a little different. The writing style is a lot different, actually, from what John has written. John was exiled to an island called Patmos off the coast of Greece. It's something like 60-plus miles off of the coast. This isn't like a swim back to shore. This is in the middle of the ocean. And so he's on this big island by himself. They think it was where Romans may have exiled enemies of the state if they weren't going to crucify him. And so he's living on this island. And this is a time in the Christian story where it's about AD or CE 90, so it's about 60 years after Christ has taught, died, resurrected, and left. And so the church has been around for six decades. This is a lifetime, or lifetimes for some of these people. He's called John the Elder because like very few people made it to this age. And this is a time in Christian history where Rome started to become hostile towards Christians. Initially, they were kind of apathetic. It was really the Jewish establishment and those leaders that were hostile to Christianity, and Rome kind of went along with it. But towards the end of the first century, Rome started to really, really crack down on other religions. Emperor worship became more and more of a thing. The society felt like it was becoming more and more toxic to Christians, or that they were persecuting Christians more. And so a lot of churches and a lot of Christians had to go into hiding. It was almost a crime in some places to be a Christian. And so this is the environment. So this guy John is on the island, and he writes this letter to people, and he's writing to Christians who are living in this time that's not very hopeful, that feels like things are falling apart for them, that feels like life doesn't have any hope. And he gets this vision from God, and he writes this vision down, and he sends this letter out. Now, Revelation has a lot of kind of interesting metaphors and visions and different things. And people for thousands of years have tried to figure out what it means. Most scholars, though, think that John is writing in a lot of ways in code. So using metaphors for things that a first century Christian would understand, but to us seems a little strange. So if we wrote a letter to someone talking about the border and healthcare and something to do with China, making references, 2,000 years from now, they wouldn't understand the climate and the context of which we are writing. And we could use metaphors, and all of us might understand, but someone in the far future maybe wouldn't understand those references. They had to write in these ways because if someone was caught with this letter and it was too overt about what they were talking about this empire that was persecuting them, then they could get into a lot of trouble. It might cost people lives. So this letter is written in a lot of ways in code. But people get lost about the confusing parts. And they forget that this is actually a letter of hope. This is John writing to a frustrated, sad, defeated people and saying, listen, 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 listen. In the end, everything works out. In the end, the good guys win. In the end, God is doing something, even though it doesn't feel like it. This is really where this letter comes from. And so the last two chapters of the Bible, of this letter, which, by the way, when it was originally written, it didn't have chapters and didn't have verses. It was just a letter. We put those in later. The last parts of this letter are about what we believe is going to happen, about what God is doing in the world and how things are going to end. And so I wanted to show you this today, and we're going to unpack it a little bit so you will feel a little more comfortable with how the Bible ends, and you'll know what Christians believe. So here's what John writes at the end of his letter. He says this, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the former heaven and the former earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne say, 'Look, God's dwelling is here with humankind. He will dwell with them, and they will be his peoples. God himself will be them, with them as their God, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death will be no more.'" And you might have heard this part. "There will be no mourning, crying, or pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Then one seated on the throne said, 'Look, I'm making all things new.' And he also said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.'" Now, some of you have been in church all your whole lives, and you kind of have been around this chapter before. You've heard some of these verses before. You might have an inkling of what we're talking about. Some of you might never have seen this at all and have no idea what it's talking about. And so I want to make sure that we're unpacking it so all of us can be on the same page here. So at the beginning of this, it says, "I saw a new heaven and a new earth." And it says this, "A new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God." Now, this isn't talking about like a spaceship like descending from space and coming down. This is possibly a metaphor. It might be literal. But what I sometimes think we do is we miss the point of what it's talking about. New Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the kind of holy center of the world. It's a place where people pilgrim to still today, thousands of years later, from all sorts of different religions to go attend holy places. It's an amazing experience. Maybe we'll lead a trip there ourselves as a church someday. And here's a picture of some of the famous sites of Jerusalem. You can see here, this is called the Western Wall. It's that wall to the right side here. This is 2,000 plus years old. This is the Second Temple. And the temple was built on this huge platform. And so this is called the Temple Mount. You might have heard of this. So originally, the temple sat on this mount. And the temple is where first century Jews throughout time thought that God's presence dwelled. So that God dwelled there. And so Jews all across the world would pilgrim once a year to go to this temple to give their sacrifices, to reconnect with God, and then they would go back home. This was a holy, 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 holy place. Well, the temple was destroyed in the first century. And before the letter of Revelation was written in the 70s, and it was written in the 90s, Rome came in and destroyed the temple. It was gone because the Jewish people were too hard to handle. So Rome just squashed their rebellion by destroying their holiest of temples. I went here a couple years ago, and you can still see in their stone at the base of the Temple Mount, where they had like stone roads, where they threw off these giant blocks that had built the temple, and they threw it off, and it's dented. You can still see the dents from 2,000 years ago where they threw and destroyed this temple, and like they were so heavy that you see the remnants of how they destroyed it. And so this was uncovered, and for a while, this was the only part of the Temple Mount that you could see, which is why it's become like a global phenomenon. And Jews and Christians all over the world go to this wall right here, and they put in their prayers. If you ever see, they'll like put their head on the wall and they'll tuck some prayers into the cracks of the wall here. Well, they've excavated a lot more of the Temple Mount since in the last few decades. And this gold dome, if you've ever seen a picture of Jerusalem, this gold dome is actually a Muslim holy place. So this is the Dome of the Rock, and on top of the Temple Mount is a mosque next to this. So back a few hundred years ago, a Muslim empire had control of this area. And so while it became a Jewish state and became Israel, it's still controlled by Muslims. And so in the 90s, like there was going to be a peace treaty that was formed between Palestine and Israel. And it was so close. It was under the Clinton administration. And it fell apart because they couldn't agree on how they would, who would be able to do what with this part. That whole Middle East area, that whole treaty fell apart because they couldn't agree on what to do with this area. This is Jerusalem. This is the center. To the first century people reading this, the idea that a new Jerusalem comes down is the is John saying to these people, listen, even though the temple is gone, God's coming back. It was this very, very, very hope-filled idea. It wasn't that God was going to destroy Jerusalem. No, God's coming back. God's going to dwell with us in a way that we've never experienced before. Like, this is what they believed as Christians. And this is what John was encouraging with. Okay, but here's what happens. Let's go back to the passage for a second. So sometimes Christians read this a passage like this, and they think it means that God's going to destroy heaven and earth and make a new one. And so I want you to be aware a little bit of what some of these words mean. They were written in Greek originally, and so I'm going to help you all know what I know, and that's what I Googled. And so, but there's a few words here that help make this come to life a little bit. So first of all, he says here, a new heaven, a new earth, a new Jerusalem, and then he says, God says, behold, I make all things new. When we think of new, we think of, okay, the vacuum broke, throw it in the dumpster, and let's buy a new one. You know, it's a replacement, it is a different item, it is a new thing. There's a word in Greek for that word, it's called neos. And this is, it says here, here's the definition, new on the scene suggests something new in time. So something ends and a new thing begins. And it says it's in contrast to its near synonym, kainos, which is new in quality. And kainos is the word here being used in Revelation. So let's look at this one. It says this, properly new in quality. It's a new thing. It's nothing we've seen before. It's a new quality. It's innovation. It's fresh in development or opportunity, not found exactly like this before. This isn't new linearly as something ends and something new begins. This is new, like renovated, reclaimed. This is a different newness here that we're talking about. And it also says, the old things have passed away. So we use the word passed away to mean that someone died. Oh, I'm so sorry that your uncle passed away. That's not what this says. It says this word literally means like departed, it left. So the best equivalent I could give you is this. If you went and renovated your living room and someone came in and said, oh my goodness, this looks like a different house. Where'd your old living room go? I can't believe this is the same place. This would be the equivalent of the words here. Is it like something new has emerged here? It's not that you took your living room and you destroyed it and then you rebuilt a new one. That's not what happened. There's a renewal here, a freshness that hasn't been experienced before. And that's what these early Christians are talking about. And I spent a little bit of time helping you understand this because I want you to know what's in the Bible. The Bible believes that God cares so much for us, for earth, in heaven, that God's going to help it become intertwined to bring out something new, to return, to dwell, to set up shop, to live among us, to make home here. So often what we do is we have an attitude of we have an escape pod from earth to heaven. What the Bible actually teaches is that God comes and makes a home here. This is a way different idea than what most Christians are taught or what most people talk about. is that God cares so much for this place. God's reclaiming this place, not just throwing it away. And I'm sharing all of this, and I know it's pulling some of your attention spans to its max, but I'm sharing all of this because what you believe about the future impacts what you do now. And I put it up here because I want you to read this too. I want you to take this home. What you believe about the future impacts what you do now. Here's another example. I read a study that surveyed more than 800,000 at-risk teens enrolled in violence prevention programs. They got into these programs because at least two-thirds of these participants had been in a fight. A quarter of these participants had threatened someone with a weapon. These were kids that were predisposed to violence. And so they go through this program, and what they found is there was one thing that really showed if a student would change their behavior, and it was hope. Students who had plans for the future and positive outlooks, they had something that they were looking forward to, something they wanted to accomplish, were less likely to commit violent acts, even though they were all violent ahead before this. That if you have hope for something that's coming, your behavior is going to change. What the things you do are going to change. Because if the future has hope, then that gives you motivation about what you do now. Here's another way to think about it. If you went to work this week and your boss was like, listen, you're doing a great job, I'm cutting your pay in half, it's just where things are tight, is that cool with you? And you wouldn't say, oh yeah, that's great, that's fine, let's keep going. I just love the company, I'm just here because I like making a difference, selling shoes. You wouldn't have this attitude. You'd be like, what, my pay is docked? You wouldn't have the same motivation because your future looks different. Would you renovate your home if you knew that it was going to be demolished next year? No, why would you put the effort and the energy into that if it was just going to fall apart? Would you give to a church that you knew was going to close its doors next year? No, because that would feel foolish. You're going to adjust your behaviors based on what you feel about the future. And this works both ways. If you think that the future is going to be bad, your actions are going to reflect that. If you think the future is hopeful, your actions are going to reflect that. I had this conversation with a guy years ago. And I was helping at this church, and we were helping set up like a fall festival or something. And he took a bunch of like plastic bottles that were empty, and there was a trash can and a recycling bin right next to each other. And he just throws them straight into the trash can. And it looked like he actually looked, considered, and then purposefully threw it in the trash can. And I was like, "Hey, man, what are you doing? Like you just why didn't you recycle those?" And he was like, "Ah, I don't recycle." And I was like, why? You literally went out of your way. Just even if you don't believe in it, it was like you chose the negative one there. And he's like, God's going to destroy the planet and make it new anyway. And I was like, that escalated quickly. By the way, I told that to one of my seminary professors, and he was like, that conversation didn't happen. I was like, yes, it did. That actually happened. Someone said that to me. There's a guy out there who's like, I'm not going to recycle, not because of any philosophy I have. It's just that God's going to destroy the planet, so why waste your efforts? Like, that's his logic. He doesn't see a hopeful future. Nobody told this guy that God wants to reclaim the world and us. So he's just going to discard stuff. He doesn't care. So if you what you believe about the future changes how you act now. And it did for that guy. But his reasoning was spot on, because what you believe about the future impacts what you do now. So as Christians who have a hopeful belief about the future, what does that mean for us? Well, this is what our scripture reading earlier was about. Paul wrote to this church in Corinth about what do we do as Christians who believe in a hopeful future. What does that mean? Does that mean that we just wait for God to do stuff? Or do we have a part in this? Well, Paul says we have a part in it. And this is what he said, and you've heard this, but I want to repeat it again. As a result of all of this, my loved brothers and sisters, you must stand firm, unshakable, excelling in the work of the Lord as always, because you know that your labor isn't going to be for nothing in the Lord. Another translation says, your labor won't be in vain. The things that you do won't be in vain. What you do matters, because ultimately God's going to reclaim things. This is Paul not just writing to Christians 2,000 years ago. This is Paul writing to us too. He says, listen, and I don't know if you need to hear this, but I need to hear this. Your efforts matter. Yes, the world doesn't seem like it's in a great place. Stuff seems like it's heading in a bad direction. And it feels like almost like that story with the starfish, that there's this beach with all these starfish that are washed up, and there's this little girl, and she's thrown some back in the ocean, but there's hundreds of thousands of them out there. And someone says, what are you doing? You can't save them all. And the girl says, well, I saved that one, and I saved that one. You know, we feel that way about our deeds in this world. It feels like people have tempers. People are out for themselves. It feels like if you do anything good, it feels like it's just throwing another starfish in the ocean. What good does it do? And what Paul is saying is all of the good things you do still matter. That ultimately God is going to reclaim this world, but we are helping him get a head start on things. This is why churches exist. This is why Christians are invited to participate in what God is doing. And it's something that churches all over the world forget. That this isn't just, the idea isn't to just go to heaven and forget everything else. The idea is that what we do here matters. That your life and your impact and your gifts, that they matter in this world. And I don't know about you, but I struggle sometimes that I feel like what I do doesn't actually make a difference. And what Paul is saying is, it makes all the difference. Because Christ is going to reclaim this world, and you and I are invited to join the construction crew. And this looks like a lot of different, there's a million different ways that you can do this, and that all of us can uniquely do this. When you give someone the benefit of the doubt instead of amping up stories in your head about someone, and we all do this, right? Like that person doesn't text you back or something goes wrong and they don't show up and you're like, they're doing it on purpose. They're out to get me. They're trying to make me upset. And maybe it was just an accident. We don't give people the benefit of the doubt. When you stop those stories and you give someone some grace, you're reclaiming this world a little bit in your own head. And when you buy that homeless guy lunch and you hear his story and you treat him like a human being, you're reclaiming this world a little bit. And when you open up your home to that foster kid and you make them feel like a family and like they matter, you're reclaiming this world a little bit. And when you give your time or your energy or your finances and you don't expect anything in return, you're reclaiming our world a little bit. And when you encourage someone because they just keep facing obstacle after obstacle and you just want them to feel like they're not in this alone, you reclaim this world a little bit. And when you speak up for justice, even though it's controversial, you reclaim this world a little bit. And when you spend an hour each week helping a kid from an underprivileged world learn to read better, you are helping reclaim this world a little bit. These aren't just doing good things. You're teaming up with the reclaimer of the universe, reclaiming this world is. And this is what church is. We gather together. We are a reclaimers club. We are coming together to be recharged, to be rejuvenated, to be re-excited, to have our passion and our hope reignited, because what we do as Christians matters in the world out there, and it matters to God. And so I want to end with this. I want to end with a challenge for you. And the challenge is this. A lot of us go the way of where science fiction has gone, and we become cynical about what the future holds. And cynicism is the easy way out. It is so easy to be cynical. Cynicism lets you off the hook because you don't have any responsibility if it's just going down the drain. But hope takes effort. Hope takes intentionality. And so I want to leave you with a challenge about hope versus cynicism. And this comes from an unexpected source. It's from a guy named Stephen Colbert. He's the host of The Late Show, but he's also a Christian and a Sunday school teacher, something you may not have known. And no matter what you feel about his TV show, he has some great advice. And he says this, cynicism masquerades as wisdom, but it is the farthest thing from it because cynics don't learn anything. Cynicism is self-imposed blindness, a rejection of the world because we are afraid it will hurt us or disappoint us. Cynics always say no, but saying yes begins things. Saying yes is how things grow. Saying yes leads to knowledge. So, for as long as you have the strength to say yes, and this is the hope that Christians have, is that we are people that even though it's a dark world out there and sometimes it feels like things are falling apart or getting worse, we're people who say yes. And so may you, friends, say yes to partnering with God's biggest reclamation project. Would you pray with me? God, thank you for loving us. Thank you for hope. Thank you for in the midst of all the stuff that's going on in our lives, and you know the story of every person in here, and you know what we're struggling with, you know what we're wrestling with, you know when cynicism rises up inside us and clouds our minds and our hopes. And so God, work in us. God, give us some hope. God, help this church be a beacon to the community that when a lot of people tell themselves the narrative of how things are getting worse, we can be a people who says, but watch this. Watch what we can do together. Watch how God's going to use us for something more. And so, God, encourage us. Thank you for loving us. In your holy name we pray. Amen.